If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It was such a charged kind of aloneness at that time because, yeah, as you say, I had just left the wrong career, which was law. I had just left the wrong relationship that I had been in for the previous 7 years. And I was now out there floating around by myself in this apartment, not knowing what my work was going to be or whether and when I would find love again. It was a very liminal type of time, you know, like an in-between moments type of time. But it was also like a beautifully charged time. It wasn't like sad or scary. It was like really, it was sort of like exciting.
Hi, and welcome to Alone Month, the podcast about time alone and why it matters. I'm Francesca Spector, host of this podcast and author of Alone Month, a book based on this very show. I'm also a reformed extreme extrovert who, a few years ago, discovered the life-changing benefits of spending time alone. Each week, I interview someone I'm curious about to discover what solo time means to them. In every conversation, we celebrate the unique benefits of time spent alone, regardless of your age, life stage, or relationship status. Because when alone time isn't lonely, it's alonement. You know what? I've been waiting a while to say this. Welcome back to season 8 of Alonement, my podcast about alone time and why it matters. This one has taken a little bit longer to put together, and you know what? I've been itching to get it out, and I think that it's all the bigger and better for it. So thank you for your patience, and I hope that you're going to enjoy this season, kicking off with, well, one hell of a guest. To begin this episode, and you will appreciate it was worth the wait, I have one of the most all-time requested guests on this show, Susan Cain. Susan is known as the rock star of the introvert world. Her 2012 book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, is still topping the New York bestseller list. While her follow-up book, Bittersweet, How Sorrow and Longing Make Us Whole, recently joined it there a decade later. In this conversation, we discuss the idea of free trait theory, the idea that you can pretend to have qualities like, for instance, extroversion in certain scenarios. We also talk about the joy of alone togetherness, the bittersweetness of both alone time and being single, and the relationship between alone time and spirituality. Oh, and she accidentally becomes my dating guru for a bit at the end, which was an unexpected direction, but we'll get there later. Susan describes herself as a happy melancholic. And after listening to this conversation, you probably understand what she means by that. She's a highly individual thinker, and you come away, well, I came away at least, considering everything from solitude to sad songs with a newfound appreciation. I loved talking to her, and I'm pinching myself that I get to share this episode with you all. This season is brought to you by Westlab, the UK's number one trusted bath salts brand. Their best-selling Dead Sea bath salt range contains minerals that come from the famous waters themselves. Fun fact, it's actually a lake, not a sea, that's found in the lowest point of the earth and was the world's first spa, visited by Cleopatra herself. Dead Sea Salt is a skin hero containing a unique blend of magnesium, calcium, and potassium, which is brilliant for protecting and repairing your skin barrier and managing conditions like eczema, psoriasis, acne, and sensitive skin, together with soothing any aching muscles. I'm also kind of in love with magnesium for its mood balancing qualities. It's nice to think that your mind and body are being looked after while you're soaking there in the tub. West Lab Dead Sea Bath Salts are vegan, cruelty-free, and suitable for the whole family. Use the code ALONEMENT15 for 15% off when you spend £10 or more. T's and C's in the show notes. Susan, as I mentioned in my introduction, you're one of my most requested guests on this show. You're famously an introvert doing a very extroverted activity of promoting yet another best-selling book. How has it been this time around compared to when Quiet came out?
Well, thank you so much for having me. Gosh, how has it been? I would say always when I go into what I think of as publicity mode, there's always a sense of like having to propel myself outward from where I am naturally supposed to be. And once I'm in that outward space, I get used to it and I start to enjoy it. But there's always this feeling of like, okay, I'll be glad to go back into my natural home when this is done. And I think that's a really useful way to think about it, because all of us in our lives have to go into those outward spaces all the time, whether we want to or not. I know that you're an extrovert, so for you, that's more of a natural place to be. It's a funny thing, as an introverted writer, because I write about introversion, when I do book tours and things like that, I always have, you know, all these people kind of around, sort of fussing around me and saying, are you sure this is okay? Is this too much? And I always think, you know what? Almost all of your writers need this. Like, I'm not the only one. I'm just the one who happens to talk about it.
Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, there was a study that came out. I think it was an Israeli study a couple of years ago, which actually showed that we all benefit from some degree of solitude, you know, introvert or extrovert. So I suppose in a way, you're identifying something that in little and large ways is also quite universal, because even speaking as an extrovert who loves parties, there are times where I want to go and hide away as well in certain social scenarios. Particularly for me, it's group fun. I hate anything that's a kind of contrived group fun situation, like a sort of escape room or something like that. But do you think that actually maybe you've had extroverts in your life come to you and say maybe you've tapped into something that they weren't quite realizing they needed as well?
Oh, yes. I hear that all the time from people. And I saw it actually, especially during the early days of the pandemic, when people were still in lockdown mode, a lot of extroverted friends saying to me, you know what, I'm realizing that the life that I had before was too much even for me. You know, and that there are aspects of this new quiet that I'm appreciating and wanting to continue even when this lockdown situation stops. So I do hear that a lot from people, and from extroverts, just because the nature of our world, it's so always on in a way that humans were never designed to be. We were never meant to be that way. And then at the same time, I hear from a lot of extroverts who will say that they would like to learn how to be more comfortable in solitude the way that you are. One of my best friends in the world, her name is Judith. We've been really close since college. And she's very extroverted. She's very social. She wants to be talking all the time. And when I was working on Quiet, I went to visit her out in California for a while. And I was staying at her house, and I would go to the local Starbucks to like work on my book. And I would be there for like 25 minutes, and then she would show up and be like, are you done yet? Like, can we talk now? I think there's something of like, oh, many extroverts will say to me, well, I would love to be able to have the pleasure of being able to do yoga or meditation or just sit still without feeling kind of a craving to go outward. A lot of the cultural discussion that we have tends to be about the adjustments that introverts need to make in order to thrive in our extroverted world. But I think it really goes both ways. I think that all of us need to learn to make adjustments, you know, to find a, a greater sense of balance.
I really like how you say that, not least because it really taps into the premise of what I suspected for my book and what then I came to explore. So the idea, for instance, that you can develop these things called solitude skills. So it's a researcher in the US, Virginia Thomas. She's looked into these particularly solitude skills that you can develop to be more comfortable in your own company. And they are things like developing emotional regulation through being able to journal or to meditate. And then that making you feel more comfortable to sort of decompress in your own company to then get all the nice benefits from it. For instance, mm-hmm. being able to read a great book or things like that. It actually reminds me of a chapter in Quiet where you do talk about how introverts might benefit from being kind of pushed into this pseudo extroversion in some scenarios. And you draw on something called free trait theory, which says mm-hmm. in a nutshell that we're able to adopt personality traits when it comes to the service of personal projects. And I imagine for you, that's public speaking, for instance, which you've then gone and won awards for. And that is, you know, very typically extroverted kind of quality. So in what ways do you think that, as you alluded to before, that extroverted people can benefit from doing the same, that sort of cosplaying introversion?
Well, I mean, the whole idea of free trait theory, it comes from the work of this amazing personality psychologist named Brian Little. And the whole idea of it is that all humans have what he calls our core personal projects. And these are the people, the causes, the work that we love most and really want to devote ourselves to. And the idea is that in the service of those core personal projects, we can and often must step outside of our normal comfort zone for the sake of this larger goal that we have. You know, so in my case, I had this book, these books that I really care about. And the only way to be able to advance those books and those ideas was to become comfortable with public speaking, because that's just kind of how it goes nowadays. So I had to step outside my comfort zone to get there, but you're doing it not out of a sense of there's a deficiency in me that must be corrected. It's not that at all. It's rather, here is a goal that I love and I will do what I need to do to achieve that goal. And when you do it that way, you're doing it with a sense that once you've achieved the goal, you get to come back and be you. So when we're talking about extroverts and alone time, I wouldn't really say that that's something extroverts need to do in like some, I don't know, in some platonic way. It's rather, is there some goal that the person wants to achieve that they can't unless they master this skill? You know, I know for many extroverts who I've spoken to, there's a feeling of like, well, I'd like to not be lonely when I don't have a ton of friends around. You know, I'd like to be able to rely more on my own company, rely more on myself. And that's a worthy goal. And so then you do what you need to do to get there. But it's not that there's anything wrong per se with, you know, one's bubbly extroversion and desire to be around people and, like, you know, kind of a wonderful reaching outward socially. Like, those are wonderful things. There's nothing wrong with them. It's just, is it or does it or doesn't it happen to be stopping you from some other goal you'd like to achieve?
Yeah. And I like that you put it that way, because I think that even in the process of sort of promoting a book, representing something, you know, you're widely regarded as a thought leader. And you then, I imagine, you know, the world thinks in black and white. This is quite natural. Uh-huh. You almost become quite polarized. But I like that you kind of acknowledge the nuance there, that, you know, actually they're nice things to be both ways. And actually it's something that we don't necessarily need to like force ourselves to take on different qualities, but it can be nice to enjoy that fluidity between the two.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so for some people, this is just a non-issue, and I wouldn't make it into an issue unless you feel that you're craving something that you're not having at the moment. And then there probably is a way to have it.
Absolutely. And really nice to have books that give you the tools to do that. I'm interested about, so earlier you said that you were working from a Starbucks, which is interesting. Because obviously I think when we talk about alone, sometimes I think we envision this sort of hermit like state on a rock, right? It's got to be, you know, it's like, oh, well, that's not properly alone because, you know, you were in Starbucks, you're in a co-working space, you're in this, you're in that. But actually I think that many of us acknowledged perhaps during lockdown, particularly, that there's a sort of alone togetherness that can be quite comforting as well. That feeling that you referenced, the sort of feeling of an extrovert wanting to feel that there's people around sometimes and not feeling lonely in their own company. Do you think we can all benefit from that alone togetherness sometimes? And it doesn't necessarily need to be so black and white.
Absolutely. I think that that's why co-working space and Starbucks and cafe life and all of it, that's why it's always been so popular. I think many, many people love that state of alone together. I mean, I wrote All of Quiet in this amazing cafe in Greenwich Village where I was living at the time that drew artists and writers and professors from all over New York City would just come and hang out there. And a lot of the time, like if you looked around, people were like this in the cafe, like inside their own heads, but very much together. I mean, there's something about feeling other people's energy in a context in which you're not compelled to be interacting that is just incredibly comforting, inspiring, illuminating, like all of it. That was actually probably what I missed most during lockdown was that. And I actually think family life can sometimes be that way. So like my husband and my two boys, they love, love, love. They're like obsessed with American football. So on the weekends during the fall, they're just like in front of the TV watching football all weekend long. And just the other day, they were saying to me, oh, Mom, I'm sorry, this is another one of those football weekends. And I was like, no, you know, I actually find it incredibly cozy to have them like in the house doing their thing and I'm in the house doing my thing. And I still feel together, even though we're not interacting at that moment. There's an incredible preciousness to that. So yeah, I mean, to your point about nuance, I do think that we think about these things in way too black and white a way.
It reminds me actually, as you're talking, and I wondered about this, whether you've recreated this in your own family, because in the dedication in Quiet, you referenced something really beautiful, how with your late grandfather, who he was a widower, and you used to go over to his house on Saturdays, which I know is the Jewish Sabbath, so you sort of won't have technology or anything like that, and you used to all sit and curl up and read your books together. And you write, it was the best of both worlds. You had the animal warmth of your family right next to you, but you also get to roam around your adventure land inside your own head, which I think is a really beautiful description. And it's so lovely that you've then got that in your own family. That's, you know, that kind of alone together scenario, just in a different way.
Yeah, it's a very different way with the football games. But yeah, it is kind of like that. And I think that's because, I mean, it's not that our family life is always like that. We have plenty of times where we're interacting too, or plenty of times where, you know, one person's out of the house doing one thing, one is doing another. But I do think that there's just something lovely about that state.
And so in Bittersweet, so it's a sort of blending together of wonderful research and expert insights, but also a memoir from yourself. And there's a time where you sort of reflect on when you were age 33, you were living alone, you'd ended your 7-year long relationship, and you were in a small rented flat by yourself without much furniture. And this was a new start in your life, but also one that was possibly a little bit scary or possibly very new. Tell me about what the aloneness associated with that time felt like.
Oh, that's such an interesting question. It was such a charged kind of aloneness at that time because, yeah, as you say, I had just left the wrong career, which was law. I had just left the wrong relationship that I had been in for the previous 7 years. And I was now you know, kind of out there floating around by myself in this apartment, not knowing what my work was going to be or whether and when I would find love again. And so it was a very liminal type of time, you know, like an in-between moments type of time. But it was also like a beautifully charged time. And I know this because still, even though that was quite a while ago now, still when I hear the songs that I happen to be listening to during that time, the songs take me back instantly to what that state felt like. And it wasn't, and so the state, it wasn't like sad or scary. It was like really, it was sort of like exciting. I happened to be listening at that time to the David Gray song "Sail Away," and it did feel like that. I felt very, very intensely as if I were on a river, you know, like floating somewhere, but going somewhere. And I do think those in between states in which we find ourselves alone can be that way. You're somehow going somewhere. And at the time, that apartment that I lived in was across the street from a church, this really gorgeous, beautiful, tiny little jewel of a church that was sandwiched in between the skyscrapers of the city. This church was from the 19th century, this tiny little thing. And I would go there almost every day and sit there for hours. And it's just kind of absorbing the beauty of that place. And I was very much alone and very happy. And that sense of being on a journey someplace. And I you know, when we're comfortably ensconced in, you know, the bosom of our friends and families, that's a wonderful place to be too. But I think it has less of the sense of a river to it, maybe. It's more of the sense of having arrived at a place for a time. And that's wonderful in and of itself. But I think life just presents these different moments, you know, and you have to kind of lean into them, whether it's they're the river moments or the cozy arrival moments.
Thank you for that reflection. And I think it will resonate and maybe give a sort of reframing to a lot of people who listen to this. And I can say quite honestly, you know, myself included, I'm at an age where I'm 31, I live alone, I'm single, I work for myself. And there is that beautiful freedom to that. But there's also that sense of being untethered. And I wonder whether it speaks to, or, you know, I believe it speaks to why Bittersweet, a book which celebrates what we might perceive as more negative or difficult emotions like sorrow and longing alongside times like happiness. I wonder if that's the bittersweet elements of your personality, of that appreciation for the bittersweet that was able to enjoy or appreciate that time at the time, because I think that's quite amazing that you were able to make that mental leap. A lot of people perhaps wouldn't be able to appreciate it while they're in it.
That's really interesting. And also that you talk about the idea of being untethered, because I will tell you that so right after I left my law firm and, you know, and I was in this untethered state, I started writing this memoir about leaving the wrong relationship and the wrong career all at once. And I wrote the memoir in prose form, and I also wrote this version in sonnet form. And so that's what I was working on at that time of my life. And the working title that I used for the memoir was Free Fall. You know, so talk about untethered. And I had that title partly because my mother said to me after, when this had happened, she's like, oh my gosh, like everything's gone upside down. You're in free fall. It just sort of came out of her mouth. And I was so struck by it when she said it, because I partly felt that. I mean, free fall has a connotation of like danger to it, right? Like anything could happen. You're just hurtling through space. And so I did partly feel the danger of it. But I also felt, as I say, the serenity and adventure of being on more of like a raft floating down a river. So I felt those things simultaneously, and I was trying to explore all that. But I do think you're right. I mean, I think almost every stage of life has that kind of duality to it, that bittersweetness evokes, you know, that every stage has the dangers and the adventure, or, you know, the simultaneous confinement and coziness, or there's always the simultaneous either or black, white. It's all there together at the same time. And you said at the beginning, we live in such an unnuanced society. And I think that's really so much of our problem in dealing with almost every life stage, is that we think everything is all one or all the other, when in fact, it's always been both. It's always been joy and sorrow simultaneously. You know, it's always been adventure and.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Stability simultaneously. That's just kind of how it is.
You know, it's in the way that bittersweet is framed. One of the examples of what is bittersweet is music, is creativity, but particularly you reference, you used to love, I'm sure you still do, listening to sad songs at university. And you were sort of teased for this. And there's a wonderful accompanying playlist to your book on Spotify, which is just, I must share a lot of bittersweet traits, because I was looking down and God, the Simon and Garfunkels and the Beatles and all of that. And I was like, yeah, they're kind of my favorite songs as well. I probably would have been the same as you, not quite realized that they were seen as kind of quote unquote depressing. But I don't know, there's something, I guess there's something inherent about bittersweetness and creativity that I'd never quite appreciated before reading your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you say that, because since the book came out, I have gotten so many heartfelt letters from creative people talking about how that is the essence of what propels their creativity, and they just kind of hadn't realized it before. There was this one amazing letter from a guy, he's a young filmmaker in LA. And he talked about how he all his life has loved that kind of music too, and had felt like that there was something vaguely embarrassing about it, too much tending towards depression. But the truth is that he said when he would listen to that music, he was always like grasping for the words to describe it. And what he would call it in his own mind was that holy feeling. Like holy with an H, not WH, that holy feeling. And that's what fuels his desire to create beautiful things. Because, I mean, I think what the bittersweet state does and what that kind of music does is it puts us in the mind of the gap between the world as it is versus the more perfect and more beautiful world in which we all yearn to live. And we become aware of that gap, which is simultaneously thrilling and sad. We have in mind, you know, like the Garden of Eden-like existence that we long for, like this shining, beautiful thing. It's also sad because we're not quite there. But I think that's what makes us want to be creative, like the reaching for that kind of beauty, like the reaching to create something lasting, something beautiful, something that speaks of Eden. That's what propels the human spirit. You know, when people speak about longing to go to Mars, which is not a longing that I share, but I know some people have it. I think that's what's propelling us. It's like Mars for that moment becomes a symbol of perfection and truth and beauty. Mm. So we all have our different symbols for that, but it's that state that all humans long for.
Funny, I suppose it's a bit how I feel about the yearning to spend time alone sometimes. I think, well, you know, we're told, we're socialized to think at least that, you know, we're social beings, we're naturally tribal beings. That word natural comes up time and time again. But there's something very anti-evolutionary almost about our yearning to be alone. Like, I wonder whether the urge to appreciate sadness and association with, you know, death and melancholy, some, it comes from the same kind of place. You know, I wonder if it's something that's the part of us that's the soul rather than that sort of, I don't know, more gratified animal instincts to be happy and hedonistic and something like that. The holiness seems quite appropriate in that context.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that because, you know, you look at all the religious traditions and the religious leaders who come back to the social group with their epiphanies, they come back from having gone out to a place of solitude, you know, whether it's Moses or Jesus or Muhammad, like, or Buddha, they go off by themselves. They go off by themselves for a long time. And that's where the revelations come from. And then you look at like, well, what are those revelations? What are the truths that they're bringing back to the community? I mean, they're often bringing back truths of like how to deal with the fact that human beings will suffer and human beings will die and human beings will love and they will also lose. That's really what religions are grappling with. And that place of aloneness is the place where the grappling happens. You know, the shaman living on the edge of the forest, like that, that's, so all these articles and these people talking about how, you know, we're evolutionarily designed to be social beings. Yes, it's true, but that's not the whole picture. I don't believe that's the way that's never been the sum total of how humans live. And all you have to do is look at these ancient accounts to know that that's true.
I'd never thought about it like that. Religion is so often associated with a sort of, you know, communality, you know, which is great in and of itself. And I think in the secular world, we're still trying to sort of replace that coming together of religious buildings. But actually within religious texts, there's also that built-in appreciation for solitude, for aloneness, and for what you can get from that.
Yeah, yeah. And also a sense in all the religions that to dive into the state of longing and yearning, which we don't like in modern day society. We think there's something, you know, dark about it or depressive about it or something like that. But, you know, the mystical sides of all the religious traditions teach that to long for the beloved, to long for the divine is to come ever closer to reaching it. It's kind of one of the great paradoxes. So there are these states of being that, you know, in modern day, like upbeat, positive psychology world, you're not supposed to dive into, but it's spiritually impoverishing us to be told not to go there. And one of the great things in positive psychology, I would say it's actually now finally evolving. You know, it started out very legitimately and understandably wanting to be an antidote to what had been mainstream psychology that looked only at human psychosis and mental illness and dysphoria. And it said, well, we should also be looking at what makes human beings thrive and flourish. So that was all great and worthy. But what happened for the first few decades was that got translated into meaning, you know, therefore we should only look at that which is cheery, optimistic, upbeat, 100% of the time, instead of understanding that human flourishing and wisdom actually comes from engaging with the dialectic of existence, you know, the joy and the sorrow that constantly must coexist because loss and love constantly must coexist. That's just reality. And so like to express it and understand it, that's where the real connection and creativity comes from. And so it's great. Positive psychology 2.0, I would say, is heading in that direction.
You have to kind of grapple for it a bit more, but there is a sort of more deep-seated optimism in that. If you can wrench the positives out of quote-unquote negative emotions like longing or that feeling that can feel more difficult.
Absolutely. Like, I always think of myself as a happy melancholic because I'm just simultaneously sort of tuned into these melancholy things of like the fact that, you know, everything must pass, everything must die, like things like that. But I'm also like deeply happy on a very, like, yeah, in a very deep level. And I do think that to tune into both and to accept both, that that's where like a truer contentment comes from.
There's an anecdote you tell in the book where you, in Bittersweet, I should be clear, we're talking about two books here, but when you had split up from your partner of 7 years, so the aforementioned scenario when you were 33, and you'd fallen headfirst in love with an unavailable musician, which is a story I'm sure that many people listening to this can relate to in some way or another. But you had a very wise friend who had quite like to steal from you, who said, look, if you're this obsessed with this person, or if you think you're this obsessed with a person, you can't be that obsessed with a person, particularly someone you're dating. You know, it's more something that can inform you of a longing, a deeper longing that you have. And she sort of pointed you towards that. And for you, that became a really wonderful vehicle to realize, right, well, you know, this person's a creative, this person's associated with words, this identified, and thank God it did, this need you had to write and to be creative and to then, you know, go on and give all the gifts you have to the world through your writing. But, you know, do you think that talking about wrenching kind of consolations out of more difficult emotions and finding the positives in them, do you think in the sort of state of singleness and dating and the chronic romantic longing that lives alongside that really, as your friend said, can't necessarily just be about a person? Do you think it can actually help us learn more about ourselves, that feeling?
I do. So especially when you get into one of those situations where you become obsessed with someone in what you know to be an unhealthy way, and yet you cannot rest yourself from it, no matter what you do, at least to understand while you're in the throes of that obsession that the person is probably just representing something that you really long for. Because nobody is sort of healthily obsessed with another person to that degree. So the obsession has something else in it that's not only about the love of that person. It's about what that person represents. So figuring out what does that person represent and what's lacking in your life that your heart is telling you, maybe erroneously, would be filled by that person. But maybe you could fill it some other way. And then I would say more broadly, like, to understand that for all of us, like, when we yearn for love and romantic love, it's the same. It's really just a different manifestation of this broader yearning that we all have for what I was calling before the perfect and beautiful world, you know, that for some people gets expressed in religious terms of a longing for the divine or heaven or Eden or whatever it is. But I'd say that the best of human nature is encapsulated in that longing. And I know that when you're like, especially in your 20s and 30s, and you're like going from date to date and relationship to relationship, and you can't quite figure it out, it doesn't feel like it's a manifestation of some higher calling or a higher yearning, but that is part of what it is. And I think it can be useful to understand it that way. And so, like, if you're going through a state where you're feeling, I don't know, sort of emotionally beat up by not being able to figure out your relationships, at least to understand this is part of a kind of grander human yearning that you are meant to feel and that you're meant to enact.
Must be almost, to reframe this and to live in this new slightly upside down world that where we're celebrating these bittersweet emotions. It's almost sad to then go into a state where you don't have that romantic longing, because it's one of the most powerful impulses, well, in the world. We're culturally conditioned to put romantic love on such a pedestal. So it reminds me of, yeah, when you watch a sort of, you know, when you watch an old movie as well, and it's all so romantic and lovely, and you'll look back and, you know, there'll sort of be teenage heartthrobs or something, and you think, oh, I could never feel that strength of feeling ever again. But I'm thinking actually particularly about the film Splendor in the Grass. Are you familiar?
No, I never saw it. No.
Oh, you know, I would highly recommend it. It's so gorgeous. But the premise is that you could never really replicate that strength of feeling, that you will never really get back that obsession that you have as sort of first love. That's something that's gone. And I remember watching it with my best friend, perhaps. Oh, it was a while ago, but it felt quite mournful, you know, like, when are we going to have that again? That mournful for that longing.
No, I completely understand it. But yeah, I think it's rather that we're going to have it again, but maybe in different manifestations. You know, it's not going to be the same feeling that we had during teenage love, but it will take another form.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to keep this on the relationships topic. I've sort of wrenched it over to, you know, you've been long married to your husband, Ken, who you say very sweetly, your extrovert pairing, your sort of, you know, sort of yin and yang, introvert extrovert pairing. How is that as a tried and tested personality combination? Would you recommend? Do you think we all need to be finding our other half as a introvert or extrovert? Delete is applicable.
Oh gosh, I mean, I've seen it go both ways. I would say, well, there's also data on this that about half the relationships are people who have mated what's called assortatively, you know, with their own type. And then there are about half of them, people mate sort of across types. And I think there's pros and cons to both ways of being. So one issue that Ken and I don't have, thankfully, he's super extroverted in the sense that, like, if he were in the room right now, you would really feel him. He's a very, very large personality. But luckily, he doesn't actually... I think he did more in his youth feel the need to constantly be going out, but he's not like that now. So we don't have that particular conflict, but a lot of introvert extrovert couples do have the conflict of, like, one person wants to be, you know, sitting home on Friday nights, curling up on the sofa, watching movies, and the other one would want to be having a big dinner party. And that needs to get navigated. But I'd say the great side of introvert extrovert relationships is, there is this sense of a kind of constant mutual wonderment. I just can't even imagine what it would feel like or how anyone could be as animated as Ken is and, like, as full of things to say and, like, full of an external, like, an outward facing life that he has. I can't imagine it, and I love it, and I find it a never-ending sense of wonder at it. And I think he probably feels some complementary version of that with me, but it's just in a very different direction. You know, I think I pull him into a place that he wouldn't otherwise go because of being the way I am. So I think that's the real beauty of relationships across type. But then I also see relationships between people of the same type where there's, like, a real sense of, like, a deep understanding of each other and, you know, of not having to negotiate differences of temperament. Just a deep sort of peas in a podness way of being. Mm. So I think there's a way to make either type work.
That's interesting. And I think I didn't actually know there was data on that. So am I right in thinking that means that so half of us pair with sort of, you know, introverts, extroverts, half of us pair with the same type as ours. There's not really a pattern.
I mean, okay, so that's what the data says. And as I say, I, you know, just walking around the world, I definitely see both types. I will say that it feels to me, just anecdotally, as if there are more introvert-extrovert relationships than introvert-introvert or extrovert-extrovert. But that's purely just my own, you know, anecdotal impression. The studies that I've seen show that it's about half and half?
I've sort of been doing an accidental social experiment where I've been aware of my sort of Myers-Briggs type, ideal pairing.
What's your type?
I'm an ENFP, but my...
Oh, yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah. I'm an INFP.
Are you an INFP?
Yeah.
So just two sides of the same coin.
Absolutely.
But I've fallen into this thing where it's not been intentional, or it was maybe a couple of times, but it's happened too many times to be a coincidence. I end up dating a type, an INTJ, who's supposed to be my ideal personality type, who's actually more towards the extreme end of introversion. And I mean, you know, the data, it's hard to say what's a success and what's not a success. I certainly don't believe if something ends, that means it wasn't a successful pairing or, you know, a nice thing to happen in your life. But it is funny because I definitely, that point that you say about the mystery is very interesting. It's quite, I don't know, I imagine it's a long time being married, right? It's a long time when you, if you do decide to commit to a long monogamous relationship. So the idea sort of appeals of being with someone who's very, very different in some regards, that constant mystery forever.
Yeah. Yeah. Though I must say, I mean, not to get like too deep in the Myers-Briggs weeds, but I would have thought that it would be very hard for a T and an F to be paired together, because it seems like those are completely different sort of moral systems, or like systems of what feels right in the world, whether you're a thinker or a feeler.
Well, the jury is out, but I'd very much like to reference this conversation one day in my wedding speech and say Susan Cain was right, or Susan Cain was wrong, as applicable.
You can let me know.
I think it's also, I have realized that I don't know whether Myers-Briggs can necessarily dictate relationships. I'm not that aware of that being a thing, apart from I think there's one very small, I think possibly not still going, dating app that does base things around Myers-Briggs. But
is that right?
There is, yeah. It's called So Synced. I don't know if it's still about, but I do know that some very special friendships I've had have come as a result of sort of being similar or compatible types. So I think that can be true, perhaps just not your life partner. I don't know.
Well, it's funny, you know, all my like hardcore research psychology friends, they all think that Myers-Briggs is ridiculous and not scientifically validated. I must say, like, maybe they're right in terms of what the testing says, but I just find it to be so useful in general that I still use it regardless of what they have to say.
Okay, so I have to ask, how about you and Ken? Are you compatible types?
Well, this is a crazy thing. In all this time, I don't think Ken has ever done Myers-Briggs, which is so crazy because when I first discovered Myers-Briggs, when I was like in my 20s, I think it was, I made every single friend that I had take it because I just found it so revelatory. I don't think he's ever done it though. But I would say he's an EN something P. On the T and the F, I would say he's like in the middle.
So you've secretly diagnosed him.
Yeah, yeah. You know, once you know someone.
and finally, so I was looking for a natural thread between quiet and bittersweet to sort of tie all this together. And the comparison I've seen being made by a lot of the press is that quiet was about sort of an underrated, you know, personality type or personality way of being. And bittersweet is about underrated personality traits and emotions. But I wonder if you'll let me have another hypothesis, because I wonder whether there's something inherently bittersweet about the time that we spend alone, given that we are born alone, we die alone, and that we can only ever really know the inside of our own heads. Is there something bittersweet that lies within that?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think that what you're talking about is something I wrote about in Bittersweet, sometimes called the pain of separation. And the pain of separation talks about the fact that we will always have to separate from those who we love the most. And, you know, we come into this world experiencing the pain of separation from the womb, right? From our mothers. So it's just the intrinsic human experience. And people talking about it in religious terms would talk about the desire always to be reunited with the divine, like a feeling of being alone and being separated and not wishing to be. So I do think there's something about that that's, excuse me, at the heart of bittersweetness, you know, the longing to connect. I think my favorite aphorism of all times is the one from E.M. Forster, just those two words, only connect, only connect. And I do think that that is the deepest human longing that perhaps, as you're suggesting, can never be fully satisfied, but that's what heaven looks like to us.
This has been a really gorgeous and really wide-ranging conversation. I'm so glad that we made the time for it. It's really, really nice to speak to you.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for having me on and for doing the work that you do. It was just such a delight to get to talk to you.
I mean, I don't know about you, but recording that episode was certainly a quasi-religious experience for me. And I really hope you enjoyed it just as much because, well, Susan was such a warm, thoughtful speaker. She was every bit worth the wait to speak to. I really hope that you also got lots out of it. I feel like we covered so much. And actually, since recording and editing this episode, I can't stop thinking about what Susan said about how romantic obsession can sort of steer us, and indeed did steer her towards her cause, that, you know, it's never really about the other person. It's about identifying that deeper longing within you. I don't know, it just really stuck with me. I'd love to hear what you thought about this first episode of the season. You can let me know via social media or email. I'll leave the links in the show notes. If you'd like to stay in touch more generally, you can join my online community on Substack. Sign up with your email address at francescaspector.substack.com to receive regular newsletters containing my more personal writing.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.